Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
This is Joshua Kane at the Midwest Genealogy Center on Saturday, September 22nd, and I am talking with...
Travis Higginbotham.
All right. And where are you from, and what are you doing these days?
I live in Blue Springs, Missouri.
Okay.
And I'm from... My dad was in the military, so I was a military brat.
Okay.
And we moved all over the country, and I was born in Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And we ended up in Little Rock, Arkansas. That's where I graduated from high school.
Okay. What brought you out to Missouri?
The military.
Okay. All right. So did you serve in the military yourself then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 1976 is when I came on active duty.
Okay. And then when did you...
I was with combat. I was a combat engineer.
Okay. And which branch of the military?
Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
Is the branch, United States Army.
Okay. Excellent. So you did that from 76 until... When did you finish?
96.
96. So 20
I did 20
years.
Years.
Fantastic. Wow. And where were you stationed in that whole, all those 20 years? Like you said, the military...
I started out in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. That's where I went to my basic officer training course.
Okay.
And from there, I went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and I was in the 46th Engineer Battalion, Combat Heavy. I was a platoon leader in a maintenance platoon, and I had a horizontal earth-moving platoon, and then I was on staff in the battalion, and then I was XO of a couple companies.
Okay.
While I was there, and then while I was there, I got sent TDY to the South Pacific on an atoll called Inuktitut.
Okay.
And I was there, this was 77, 78.
Okay.
That was when I was there. In November 77 to May of 78, did a 6-month tour. And we were cleaning up all the atomic waste and debris from all the testing that they did there during the 40s and the 50s.
Okay.
I did something like 60-something atomic tests there.
Right. On that atoll you were
on? On that atoll, the northern atoll. I lived on the southern atoll.
Okay.
And we had guys that had a base camp. It was called Lojua. And they lived on that base camp. And they actually did all the cleaning up. And we buried it in a crater called Cactus Crater.
Okay.
And it's on an island called Runic.
Okay.
And a lot of guys that worked on that ended up with all kinds of cancers and
right, from
stuff.
The radiation?
Yeah, from their work there. We had no protection. Basically, we had our protection was combat boots, shorts, and a hat, and a dust mask.
Right.
And that
was it. Gloves or anything?
No.
Did you yourself suffer anything from that, or?
No, I was lucky. I got there during the second phase. Mm-hmm. They had the first initial phase, which was like the MOB. They call it the mobilization.
Okay.
And they were setting up and building the base camp on Lojua and all the facilities on the main island where I lived. And then I came in the they called it Operation Switch. And I was in the second group, and we hadn't quite gotten around to starting to clean up. And towards the end of my tours, when they started cleaning up the islands, and I was a maintenance platoon leader.
Okay.
And so we were responsible for repairing all the wheeled vehicles and all the engineer equipment that was used in the cleanup operation.
Okay, so you didn't deal directly with like the handling of the
material. No, I sent mechanics out. I was a platoon leader, so I sent mechanics out to those different islands.
Okay.
To fix equipment when it was on, or if it couldn't be fixed there, we would evacuate it back.
Okay.
To where I was.
So you're to the bottom.
Yeah. So I was lucky. Yeah, I was in the first group. We had guys living on Lojua Base Camp at the time, and they were setting up Runic Island so that they built a quarry, they put in a rock crushers, a cement plant, and a storage facility.
Right.
Because they used Portland cement.
Okay.
You know, the bags.
Right.
So and they had a concrete mixing plant. And what they did is they brought in, they scraped off the islands. And when I was there, they did grids. They gridded all the islands.
Right.
And they used engineer equipment to do that.
Okay.
So that they could, like, organize the work, you know, be a method.
Right, keep it method.
And then they would go in there and they'd determine how much radioactivity there was left, you know, and how deep they had to go and how much material they had to remove. And then once they started actually removing the material, they would bring it back by boat. They would load it up on dump trucks. A dump truck would drive onto a landing craft.
Okay.
Then the landing craft would go to the water, would go over to Runic, and then they would dump it in an area, a stockpile, and then they would make a cement slurry out of that, and then they would pump it into the Cactus Crater.
Wow.
Which was an atomic crater.
Oh, that crater was made from the atomic
From testings. An atomic blast.
Okay. And then that, did they cover that up with concrete at the end of the
day? Yeah, it's a concrete dome over that now.
Okay. Wow. Do you know why, like, the limited supplies were given for, like, the cleanup? Like you said, you just had, like, you know, combat boots and, like, hats.
Yeah. At the time, the theory was that you weren't going to get, you'd get more radiation if you went to Denver, Colorado.
Wow, okay.
So that's what they told us.
They thought it would have gone down by that time.
Yeah, well, there's been like 20 years, and then the half-lives of the different materials out there.
Right.
And one thing they told us was don't eat anything like fish, coconuts, mm-hmm. anything grown on the islands, because the root systems and, you know, the food chain, you know, the...
Yes,
what the
ecological
what the fish,
system.
Yeah, yeah, the ecological system that you could get plutonium... it somehow would get into your organs if you ate that fish or coconut crabs or whatever it is was out there.
Okay.
But a lot of guys ended up getting sick, and they're sick now. And so anyway, the government's not being much help. So
that's unfortunate. Was there a local population on that atoll as well?
Yeah.
Or was it? Okay.
Yeah, they moved them off.
Before the testing
yeah.
or after? Before.
Okay. Before the testing.
Okay. So when you guys got there for the cleanup, there's nothing, no inhabited people?
They brought some of the natives back because they wanted, that's what precipitated us cleaning it up.
Okay.
Was because the natives, the Marshallese, were suing the United States government.
Oh, okay.
So in order to get it to where they could move back and be habitable, they, you know, needed to do this cleanup.
Mm-hmm.
But really it was just, you know, a test.
Right.
They still can't occupy the Northern Islands.
Oh, okay, that'll still shut down.
It's still
too contaminated.
You know, it's better than it was.
Right.
And it'd take like another 100 years before they'll be able to like grow stuff and eat it.
Right.
Up there.
Wow.
But population of them have moved back, and there's like three different islands. The main island I was on, and the next one, and then there's another one, Medrin, and then there's another island next to it that we went back and they built houses.
Okay.
And like community facilities. Right. And basically, they're wards of the country,
okay.
wards of the state.
Okay. All right.
And then I got back from that, and then from there I went to Germany.
Okay. How long were you in Germany for?
From 1980 to 83.
So you were still there when it was East and West Germany.
Yes.
Yeah. And what part of Germany were you stationed there?
I was in Grafenwehr training area.
Okay.
It's near Nuremberg.
Okay. All right.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Germany, but you got Nuremberg, and down here you got Munich,
okay.
and then over here you got Stuttgart.
Okay.
I was like in southern Bavaria. They called it Bavaria.
Right, southern Bavaria. Yeah,
yeah, that's
okay.
where I was.
Towards states. France or towards like Austria?
Austria.
Towards Austria.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Toward, and a little up from Italy and everything.
Yeah.
All right. And what was it like in Germany? Was it very, where were you stationed? Was it very tense? Because when you people think of like, you know, Cold War and like Berlin, that, you know, it's very.
The Germans really loved us.
Yeah.
Being there. I remember one time I was going home on leave, and all these Germans kept coming up to me and saying, tell us you're not leaving. Please, tell us you're not leaving. because the big at the time, there was talk that the U.S. was going to pull out of Germany.
Okay.
Because, you know, to save money.
Right.
And that was just a rumor. I don't even know how it got started, but they were all worked up about it. But I was with the 535th Engineer Company, and we were assigned to Grafenwehr, and we were combat support equipment. It was all heavy junk.
Okay. Like tanks and things like that?
No, or? Like bulldozers, scrapers, graders.
Okay, so more mechanical sort of.
Yeah, right, engineer-type support.
Gotcha.
We built, like, roads. We were mainly there to support the base.
Okay.
Grafenwehr was a big training area. And it had been a training area since, like, the 1880s for the Germans.
Okay.
So it was a big, huge training area. And we took care of all the roads, and we built ranges and repaired ranges because the tanks did all their firing there.
You know, okay.
Tanks would come up.
Okay.
So, and artillery came, and they used the ranges to fire artillery on.
All right.
And the whole time I was there, you know, you get, when you first get there, it's just like, and then, all the time, 24
right.
hours a day, almost. And at first it drives you nuts, but then you get used to it, and then you don't even recognize it. And then there was a period of time where they were doing range maintenance. They were rebuilding all the ranges to accommodate. We got the new M1 Abrams tank.
Okay.
And all the tank ranges prior to that being built were built for another tank. So they had to redo all the ranges because it was just different. I guess they needed different things for training on that particular weapon.
Okay.
And so then they shut down all the artillery, and there was, and it was just like deadly quiet, and like nobody was used to that. That was actually pretty nice.
Yeah, change of pace. Doing a lot of the, you said it was a big base even for the Germans back in the 1880s. Did you do joint operations with any German military, or was it only strictly U.S. military there?
It was mainly a U.S. training. We did have Germans come and train on there.
Okay.
Because they had to fire their artillery too.
Right. Yeah.
And the only thing that I did with the Germans, the reservists, they had a reservist group, and we had a partnership with them.
Okay.
So we would do we'd have parties, you know, and we would go to the ranges together, and we'd fire the German weapons, and they'd come over and they'd fire the American weapons, and they would always have, they're real big on war memorials, like anytime, like our Memorial Day,
right.
They have those too.
Right.
And they would have parades and stuff, and we would supply troops for their parade.
Okay.
And we had a real good partnership. It really worked, really worked nice.
What were a lot of the parades for Germany? Was it like World War One or like World War Two or like previous things or just in general?
It was like the war dead from World War II, all the wars.
Okay, so just a general thing.
Like for, a general thing, probably, okay. For them.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you feel any, was there like, you know, because the Cold War was almost done at that point. Was it still pretty tense, or did you feel things were a little more relaxed?
Yeah, it was real tense.
East and West, still pretty tense.
Yeah, we did a project right on the border between Czechoslovakia and Germany.
Okay.
And we were inside the one, they had this like 1 kilometer markers, and you couldn't go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And without an escort from, there was this CAV unit.
Okay.
I forget what the designation of it, but they had to provide armed troops to go with you if you ever went inside that 1 kilometer zone.
Okay.
Because the Germans, the East Germans and the communists, you know, they were all up to no good most of the time. And they would either, you know, they could probably try to come up and create a you know, some kind of a border incident.
Right.
So that they could get the press.
Right, yes.
Yeah, so we built a soccer complex for one of the villages that was on the border there.
Okay.
So that's how, you know, that was the closest I ever got. And we would, I went into East Berlin when it was still under communist rule.
Okay.
And we went, and you had to fly into West Berlin.
Right.
And then you would take, you know, a tour into East Berlin.
Okay.
And we got on the bus, and when we crossed the border, the East German girl, you know, it was a lady, and she was the tour guide. And when she got on, it was just like, she was just like drab. You know, it's like, I don't know, it wasn't in style, I guess. You know, you could just definitely tell a difference between being in West Berlin and East Berlin. And then all the buildings, I mean, just people weren't happy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they tried to play it up, you know, while we were on the bus. And we'd drive around. I think we got out a couple times. But you could definitely tell a difference.
You said it was a tour. What was it? Was it a USO tour? Or was it something like East and West did for each other?
I was like a USO tour.
Okay.
I mean, it was a sanctioned tour. They let, you know, and... you couldn't do anything, couldn't provoke anybody, and you had to be in uniform. Only U.S. troops could do it.
Okay.
I don't think any civilians could do it. So we had to be in Class A uniform, and we had to be on our best behavior. And we went out on the bus, and they showed us a few things, and they showed us a lot of war monuments, you know. And then we came back, and I could definitely tell the difference between, you know, being under a communist rule and being, you know, free.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely see it.
Right.
And the Korean, the border wall was still there, the Berlin Wall.
Right.
And that was something. And I went up to the, I think it's called the Wurzburg Gate or something. I forget what it's called, but Brandenburg Gate.
Brandenburg, okay.
All right. And it was in no man's land. And it was just all, you know, beat up and stuff. And you could see that. You had to climb up on this, like, platform to look over.
Right.
And a lot of people died trying to get out of there, trying to climb those walls. And they'd have memorials set up along the wall about this is where so-and-so died.
Right. Trying to get into the West.
Trying to get into the West, yeah.
Was there a reciprocal tour? Like, did any East Berlin, like, German soldiers or, like, Russian
soldiers?
I'm not
aware of it.
No, okay.
I would think not.
Right.
Because they wouldn't want them to see how great it is
side.
Over here on the other side.
Right.
Plus, if they did it, you know, there ain't no guaranteeing that if they decided not to get back on the bus, there wasn't going to be anyone to go make them get back
right.
on the
they
bus.
Right. They leave with 30, come back with 2.
Yeah.
Because that happens there. Okay. Interesting. Usually the German people were very appreciative and accepting of, like,
American. I only ran into one bad German the whole time I was there.
Okay. What was that like, if you mind explaining?
All the U.S. troop, you know, all the soldiers that had cars, mm-hmm. we call them privately owned vehicles, POVs, had a green license plate.
Okay.
And I was in a tourist area, and he kept going around, look at all these Americans. There ain't nothing but Americans here, or something like that. That's all he was just ranting.
Right. Okay.
I mean, he didn't direct anything at me, but
right.
I just heard him, you know, saying something about all the Americans being here. But that's the only time I ever heard anything negative.
Right. All right. Did you, while you were in Germany, did you pick up any German language or, like, German culture?
Yeah, they had a course when you got there. It was, like, basic German.
Okay.
And that was one thing about the Germans. They were wanting to learn English.
Oh, all right.
So if you just tried to speak German, then that's all. That got you in the door. Then they wanted to speak English.
Uh-huh.
But if you were a obnoxious American and you were trying to, you know, show your weight, you mm-hmm. know, and being stuck up or something, then they wouldn't give you the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
But if you'd go in there and say, you know, wo ist der Bahnhof or something, you know, ist es Zimmer frei? You know, is a room free?
Right.
And then they would want to speak English after that.
Oh, okay. That's great. So overall, it was a pretty good interaction between Germans and Americans.
And that's where I met my wife.
Okay. And she's German?
No. That was the one thing I said when I went over there. I was single. I was like 26. I was 26 years old when I went over. And I said, I'll be damned if I'm going to marry a German. Because a lot of guys were doing it.
Mm.
You know, and it's a lot of guys went to Korea, married Koreans. Yeah. And I said, I'm going to resist it. I'm not going to do it. Men and German girls were good looking. You know, a lot of resistance. And it turned out that when I was in the officer advanced course, mm-hmm. before I went to Germany, they assigned me to the 535th Combat Support Equipment Company. and it was in Grafenwöhr. And everybody laughed at me when I got my assignment because they announced it. You know, Travis Higginbotham, 535th Engineer Company, Combat Support Equipment. And I was going there to be the company commander. And everyone laughing at me, telling me it's in Graf. You know, Graf's the shithole of Germany because, you know, it's where they do all the training. All right. The people that are stationed around Germany go to Grafenwöhr to do their training. And okay. They're there in, like, in temporary barracks, or they're in the field and tents, right. You know. Right. And it's not a very good experience. All so right. Everybody was laughing at me. But I was permanent party. And it just turned out that my wife was my XO. Oh. My wife-to-be.
Right, yeah.
And that was another thing. You're going to a unit that's got women in it. And that was like, nobody wanted it. This is like 1980.
Right.
You know, and it was a lot of resistance to women being in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, it turned out that my wife was, my wife-to-be was my XO. And I had a really good first sergeant and good platoon leaders. And pretty much after about, you know, a year, my Nancy's her name, we would always go, all the officers, because we were all single, right. And we'd go to the officers club and eat, mm-hmm. You know, and we'd do things together on the weekends and things like that. And next thing I know, you know, she's saying that she wanted to go to battalion. And battalion was in a town about 3 miles, it was in Stuttgart, which is about three hours away.
Okay.
And she said that she wanted to go to battalion. And she'd always been talking negative about, you know, going to battalion. She never wanted to go to battalion. All she wanted to do was leave Grafenwöhr, you know, leave the company,
right.
And get out of the Army and go back to school because she wanted to, you know, be a college professor. She was a, she got her degree at Notre Dame,
okay.
As a civil engineer. And she was really smart. And I pretty much let her and my first sergeant run the company. And all I did, I was the disciplinarian.
Okay.
You know, I was the guy that you know, when people screwed up, I had to deal with them.
Right.
I dealt with them.
Right.
And I ended up having to fire a few NCOs and one of my warrant officers I had to fire.
Okay.
So I was like, provided the discipline for the company, and she basically ran it, her and the first sergeant. And then when she said she wanted to go to battalion, I was like, golly, you know, because I was just at battalion like about a month or two before, and the battalion executive officer specifically told me he wanted Nancy to come be his adjutant.
Okay.
And I convinced the colonel, you know, my battalion commander and the battalion XO that, you know, she doesn't want to come to battalion. She wants to stay there in Grafenwöhr, you know, stay in a company. She's going to get out of the Army. She's going back to school. And so anyway, I talked them out of bringing her to Stuttgart.
Okay, right.
So I go back and I tell her, you know, you don't have to go to battalion. I swear it wasn't a week later. She comes up to me and we're eating dinner in the officers club, and I had a steak. It was just me and her. Usually it's all the officers.
Right, right.
But that night it was just, I guess we had to work late or something, so we ate late. And I ordered steak, and in Germany, when your food is ready, they bring it to you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't wait for everybody.
Right, okay.
You know.
Right.
So.
A little different than here.
Her food came first, mm-hmm. And she ate it. And then my steak came. And I got there and I was about ready to cut that one piece of meat. And then she says, sir, I want to go to battalion. And I went, was just like, what? I just, you know, been up there and convinced them to keep you here. And I says, why are you changing your mind now? And I says, you damn women. You know, something like that. So,
right.
Why do you want to go now? She says, I just want to go. I think I need to go. You know, and I'm dumb.
Right.
I mean, she's got feelings for me. That's right. Why she wanted to leave.
Okay, right.
She started, I don't know. She would say things like she liked this particular artist, mm-hmm. You know. And I guess I would listen and I'd go buy that particular tape. Back then it was cassette
right.
tape.
Yeah, cassette tapes.
Then she would notice. And then whenever she would want to go do something, like, they have all these china marks where they make real expensive china.
Okay.
You know, like what you find in, like, the White House.
Right.
And they've got these factories that have seconds. And they put these seconds out, and all these German women and German guys go crazy trying to pick out, you know, the seconds, go through all the seconds and buy them.
Right.
Well, she would always want to go. So she'd go fight the German ladies and get all this china. And she'd always come to me and she'd say, "Sir, can I go?" I says, "I want to take the afternoon off and go to so-and-so to, you know, get china." Yeah, sure, take off, no problem. You know, and I never turned her down.
Right.
And good thing, that's where we got all our china today.
Yeah.
Got a full set.
That's great.
So
you and Nancy are still together then?
Yeah, still married. So been married since 1982.
Excellent. Okay.
And
did you get married in Germany?
No, we got married in Columbia, Mississippi.
Okay, so you came back home
in 82. Yeah, I came home on leave.
Okay.
In fact, my wedding date is the same wedding day as my parents. I didn't know it. We just picked it out.
Right.
But it turned out that the same thing. My dad was in the military. He did it over Christmas,
right?
You know, and he picked the 18th of December.
Okay.
And then we picked the 18th for the same reasons, because I was taking Christmas leave, and I was going to be back a couple days or get married, and we go on our honeymoon. Then I'd go back to Germany,
right?
Because she was at the time had moved from Germany to Fort Belvoir. She was stationed at Fort Belvoir.
Okay, so she had gone to different.
She went to her advanced course.
Okay.
And then she stayed there, and she was part of this captain's training team. They rewrote the basic course.
Okay.
Officer basic course.
Right.
And I was in Germany at the time.
Okay.
But anyway, back to when she told me at dinner that she wanted to leave, and I was like, oh my God. You know, so anyway, I had to go back to battalion, and she didn't want to be the adjutant.
No.
She wanted to be assistant operations officer, which did all the planning for training and stuff like that. So I went back there and pleaded with battalion commander to put her in the operations. And he ended up doing it. She got operations.
Mm-hmm. And then did you guys keep in touch while you were...
Yeah, she would come, like, on the weekends. She'd come back to Graf.
Okay.
And it was pretty neat because I had a spy at battalion headquarters. And she'd call me and she'd say, "Travis, battalion commander's coming down to Stuttgart right now. Coming down to Grafenwehr right now."
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
Good and he, generally, I always knew what was going on.
Right.
I had an idea because she would tell me what was going on.
Yeah, no surprises.
No surprises.
That's great. That's fantastic. So you said your father was in the military as well. So what made you join up and serve? Is it because he was in it, or did you have another calling? Or
There was a thing called the draft.
Okay.
And I was in the last year of the draft in 1971, and I had a real low draft number.
Okay.
I was like 54.
Okay.
And that year they took up to 100.
Okay.
So I would have got drafted. And the only way to get a deferment at the time was to go to college and then get into ROTC.
Okay.
So I was classified A1, and I wasn't really going to college. I mean, like, normally when you go to college, you start looking at it your junior year, you know, your senior year. Right. Hell, by the time summer comes along, your senior year, you've basically decided
where you're going. Right.
You know where you're going.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I graduated from high school, and I didn't know what I was going to do.
Right.
All I know is I had a low draft number, and I was going around to the different branches trying. Everyone says, join, don't get drafted.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead and enlist, because then you'll get what you want if you join.
Right, otherwise you have no choice.
So I was going around all these different places, and then my dad was trying to get me into the Guard, because he had connections to the Guard.
Yeah, right.
The National Guard. And my mom knew a guy, his name was Ralph Carpenter. They called him Sporty. And I wanted to play football in college.
Okay.
And he was the head football coach at Henderson State University. So my mom called him and said, "Yeah, bring him down. Bring your boy down and we'll visit." So anyway, I went down there and they showed me around campus and everything, and I decided I wanted to go to school there.
Okay.
And so I had to get in ROTC.
Okay, at that school. And yeah. Is this Henderson in Kentucky or?
No, it's in Arkadelphia, Arkansas.
Okay.
Near Hot Springs.
Okay, okay.
So I had to get in ROTC, and the second, or my junior year, for the first class, they showed up and you had to raise your right hand and swear you in into the Army.
Okay.
And they didn't give us any advance warning. We were just in there, we're all sitting in class, and all of a sudden he says, okay, everybody needs to stand up. Raise your right hand, and then you say the oath.
Repeat after me. Yeah.
And you have to sign everything.
Right.
You sign your contract and all this other stuff. And prior to that, if you got out of ROTC, they could put you on active duty and make you a PFC,
private
first class.
Right, yeah.
And then after I signed the contract, I finished out my ROTC, and they asked us to select our branches, what branch we wanted. And I said, well, I don't have an engineering degree, so ain't no way in hell they're going to give me the engineers. Because I had a biology, chemistry.
That's what you went for. That was what your degree
That's
was.
That's what my degree was.
Right.
And so anyway, I signed up. Well, I said my first choice is Corps of Engineers. Ain't no way in hell they're going to give me Corps of Engineers. My second choice was Medical Corps.
Okay.
That's what I wanted.
Right.
I wanted to be in the Medical Corps. And they says, well, you got to put a combat engineer, or you got to put a combat branch down. Otherwise, they're going to throw you right into the infantry.
Okay.
Just to spite you. This is all the crap they're telling you.
Yeah.
So I put down field artillery, armor, and something else. And I'll be damned if they give me my first choice.
There you go.
Being these two other guys, three of us got Corps of Engineers. And we had no earthly idea. Because Henderson doesn't have an engineering degree.
Okay.
It didn't have that. And we're saying, what the hell did they give us Corps of Engineers for?
No.
So we went to DeGray Lake, which is a Corps of Engineers lake down in Arkansas.
Okay.
And we talked to this officer, and he told us what all we would do in the Corps of Engineers.
And that's like where you did your training for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's not where we did training. That's just where he was stationed.
Right, so you get an idea of what was coming.
Yeah,
coming
just kind of get an idea of what the Corps of Engineers was about.
Right, I gotcha.
And then I went to Belvoir, which was my officer basic. I also did officer advanced course. After I did my time in Germany, 83, I got married in 82,
right.
Finished in 83, and we went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Okay, your wife and you together.
Yeah, together. Okay. We did a joint assignment.
Okay, well then did you serve for the rest of your time with your wife?
Or yes.
Together? Okay.
Except for when I went to Korea.
Okay, when were you in Korea?
From 90 to 91.
Okay.
I was in Korea.
All right. So 91, that would be like when the Desert Storm started. Did you serve in Desert Storm as well, or were you in Korea when it was going on?
Prior to going to Korea, I was at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I started out working for Director of Engineering and Housing, and then I got assigned to the Readiness Group, which is, I was an advisor for National Guard Battalion and a Reserve Battalion.
Okay.
And I worked with them, and then the Gulf War happened.
Okay, right.
And what I did was we became a mobilization center.
Okay.
Fort Dix.
Okay.
And all the reserve units would come in there, and they would do all their training. We would get them ready to go. We'd fill them out, you know, with all the replacements that they needed, and we shipped them over.
Okay. Was that just normal like combat? Like privates, or was it for like specifically for engineering, like what you were doing?
Anybody. Artillery, infantry, engineers.
Okay,
because I was engineer specific.
Right.
I mainly worked with engineer groups.
Right, but the whole
but
base.
But everybody, the whole base, was, all kinds of units came there.
Okay.
To get ready to go over.
Right.
And I sent out an engineering detachment and an engineer brigade headquarters is what I worked with.
Okay.
And then I went through and I had to get a physical and I had to get ready to be, I was designated as a replacement.
Okay, so you were going to go over to Iraq.
But fortunately, the war only lasted, 105 hours
or something? Yeah, less than a week or so,
Not very long. So anyway, all my friends said I didn't miss anything. Because they lived out in the damn desert before they ever did anything.
Right, so were other officers sent over there? The ones that you knew and stuff were sent over there?
I knew a lot of guys went over.
Yeah, did your wife go or she was stationed still with you on that?
She worked for the Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
And she wasn't... Generally, the people that went over that I knew were in, units, combat units.
Okay, so they were combat.
So they went over as a unit, and they were part of that.
Okay.
And then there were some people that were like, if they were in a job, I was with a readiness group. So they needed me to work training and mobilizing these guys and shipping them out.
Okay, right.
So I had a job.
Right.
So they didn't need me over there.
Over there in Kuwait, right.
So that was one good thing about my service. My time, I was real lucky.
Right.
And I was in from 76 to 96. And every time something happened, I was always at the right place at the right time, and I didn't have to go.
Right. Okay. So you didn't see any combat actually fighting?
Yeah, I didn't do that. I didn't have to go over.
Right. Were you more stateside during those times, or?
Yeah. Well, one time when Grenada, remember all that?
Right. Yeah.
Panama. I was in Germany at the time.
Okay.
So,
Right. And where did you... Your job when you were in Germany during Panama and Grenada, was it the same as in Iraq? Were you readying people to go over there, or were you just doing your normal job there?
I was just doing my normal job.
Right, so it was kind of separate. It wasn't
separate.
Connected.
I was in a theater of operation that was dealing with the Soviet Union.
Right.
So they couldn't afford to send anybody.
Yeah, you had another bigger fish.
And plus, Grenada and Panama wasn't that big of an operation.
No, they were small.
Okay. So they didn't. I wasn't needed down there.
Okay.
And I was involved in the Cuban refugees. The Cubans. Remember all the Cubans came over?
Right, early 90s or so? Or was that?
No, I think 80s? It was 1980.
Yeah, in the 80s.
Yeah, it was right around 1980.
All right.
79-80. We had to go to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas.
Okay.
And the first couple busloads that came, because they're so freaked out, They're from a communist country, and they came over, and I guess a lot of them were crooks too, criminals.
Okay.
And the first busload, first couple busloads, as soon as they opened the door, them suckers just took off, So we ended up having to build a containment, like a prison.
Okay.
And barbed wire, and we built all these, surrounded all these group of barracks, and we'd have where the bus would pull up, we'd have like a tunnel going to the enclosure.
Right, okay.
So that they wouldn't run.
They couldn't
wouldn't escape.
Way. Right, one way in kind of thing. Oh, wow, interesting.
So I was involved in all the construction.
And that was before you went to Germany?
Yeah, that was before I went to Germany.
So after you got back from the Pacific, before you went to Germany?
Yeah.
Okay. And then, I guess, kind of finish your service, what did you do after 91 and 96, after the Iraq, the Desert Storm?
I ended up in Kansas City.
Okay.
I was with the Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
And while I was here in Kansas City, my wife, they were starting to offer 15-year retirements, trying to reduce the Army. So she took a 15-year retirement.
Okay.
So she got off of active duty.
Right.
She retired as a major.
Okay.
And then I was still on active duty, and I was in Kansas City Corps of Engineers, and then the floods of 93 happened.
In Kansas City?
Yeah,
okay.
93, 94, and 95.
Oh, wow.
And so I was involved in all the, they have federal levies, and they have non-federal levies.
Okay.
And the federal levies are the ones, like in downtown, you see these big, huge levies. They're maintained by the federal government.
Okay.
And then they call it non-federal levies. They're mostly like surrounding farmland out in the, along
countryside.
The Missouri River.
Okay,
countryside.
Right.
And then, so I was... responsible for repairing all those.
Okay. And are those non-federal ones, are they under the Army? Like, with the Army,
Well, no, they have local governments. They're called levy districts.
Okay.
And they form, it's like a city.
Okay.
But only it's levy district.
Right, okay.
And they have all the levies in their district, and they're like a government. And they can I think they tax. And the federal government has an 80-20 split with them.
Okay.
So if there's damage, the federal government will pay 80%,
right,
and then they pay 20.
Okay. Okay. And they maintain, so it's like a locally maintained.
Yeah, it's like a local government. It's almost like a little, it's like a city government, but it's called levy district.
For the levies only. All right.
Yeah.
Excellent. And then you finished up in 96 in Kansas City?
Yeah.
All right.
And then I just stayed here. I lived out on Commander's Ridge. I don't know if you know where the ammunition plant is.
Mm-mm. No, I'm personally not. No, I don't know. Is that Independence or Blue Springs?
It's Independence. It's called, what is it called? The ammunition plant.
All right, yeah. Fair enough. Okay.
I can't think of the name of it right now. But anyway, there's 10 houses out there.
Okay, wow.
They were built World War II. And we lived in one of them.
Oh.
I had to live on it.
Yeah.
I couldn't live anywhere else. I was required to live on it.
Right.
So we even ended up, when we got here, had to live in an apartment until one came open.
Okay.
And I moved into
it. You lived in there with your wife and everything. What was, after you finished your service in 96, what was the transition like back into kind of civilian life? Was it easy? Was it, did you miss the military? How was it?
I really didn't miss the military.
No.
I was like, my time in the military was pretty stressful.
Okay.
The whole time I was in. I mean, it just never stopped, especially when I went to Korea.
Right.
I mean, it was like one exercise. You're executing an exercise and you're planning the next exercise. And I was an officer. So I was having to do all this planning.
Right, right.
And if you didn't keep up with it, it just, you know, really be hard. And I don't know, I just had a lot of, you know, just a lot of things that not combat related.
Right.
But just the stress of doing all the things that you're supposed to, all the planning, all the writing, and here you are, you're doing your job, you're doing all this work, oh, we need this investigation done. So I'd have to, like, on top of everything else, one time they had this theft at the officer's club.
Okay.
And I had to go in there and figure out what was wrong.
Right.
Why this money was disappearing.
Okay, yeah.
So that was on top of everything
I
was
doing. All your normal duties, right? Okay.
So it's just like, just all the time.
One thing after another.
One thing after another.
Right.
And then plus I didn't get promoted, so I got passed over.
Wow.
I was pretty bitter about that. And fortunately, though, the good thing about it was, had I got promoted, I would have been back to Iraq.
Oh, okay.
Because the Gulf War broke out.
Right.
The second Gulf War.
Oh, I see.
And I just talked to a guy upstairs, was in the service the same time I started.
Okay.
He retired as lieutenant colonel, and he's the guy up there doing the Leavenworth.
Okay.
You know, the prison.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah, he didn't have to go to Iraq, but he didn't retire till 2005.
Wow.
And I was telling him, I says, you know, I've always been bitter about not being promoted to lieutenant colonel, but, you know, in a way, had I been promoted, I'd have ended up in Iraq a couple times.
Right.
So I'm kind of glad I didn't get promoted.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So anyway.
In retrospect, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, just all the BS you put up with and all the generals. And I was an officer.
Right.
So all the hierarchy, the ass-kissing, the politics. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a very good politician.
Fair enough, right.
You know, so
much
anyway,
different experience for
a lot
you.
Of guys that got promoted
right.
didn't deserve to be promoted.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I would be like their contemporary, and we would be doing things, and they wouldn't pull their weight.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Right, right.
So we would have to pick up the slack.
Mm-hmm.
But that sucker would get promoted, and then we wouldn't.
You wouldn't, right. Yeah.
And I had one guy. See, at least I made it up to major and got to retire. I had a friend of mine in Germany, and this guy basically held his operation. He was in the Brigade S3.
Okay.
And he held that together. And this other guy didn't do nothing.
Right.
That guy ended up getting promoted to major, and he got passed over and had to get out.
Yeah. Yeah, he was doing all the work.
And he was doing most of the work, but he wasn't getting any of the credit. The other guy was a good politician.
Right. He knew how to work the angles. I see.
So it's just like politics in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes even worse.
Mm, I can imagine. Going along that, when you talk about like a promotion, do you have any regrets, or like would you do it again? Would you do the military again?
Yeah. I always tell people that if they're thinking about going into the military, to do it.
Give it a shot.
Yeah. It's a. I mean, I got to retire.
Right.
So, you know, I'm getting a pretty good paycheck every month.
Right.
Plus, my wife gets a paycheck.
That's true. Yeah.
Just from being retired.
Yeah.
So, you know, that helps out a lot.
I bet, yeah. That's good. Any regrets on the military side at all?
No. I just some of the people that I ran into, you know, I didn't particularly like serving with them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my bosses were real jerks.
Right.
You know, and you can't really, you know, I had this one guy, I ended up liking him in the end. But one time I was in this bivouac. They sent us to Eglin Air Force Base to mm-hmm. support this operation. And because I was combat heavy equipment platoon leader, they needed my engineer equipment down there okay. before the exercise started to help get things squared away. And they sent us down there with nothing, just my platoon. No place to eat, no place to bivouac.
Right.
You know, none of the logistics had been set up.
Okay.
So I had to go down there and take care of it all myself.
Right.
And I went down there and I went to this one mess area. And I said, hey, I got a water truck. And I'll keep your area sprayed down to keep all the dust down in your whole bivouac area where they had the mess tents.
Okay.
You know, where they had the mess tents set up.
Right.
If you'll let us eat with you. And the guy agreed. So he all he did was just add my platoon to his head count.
Yeah.
And I found my own bivouac area, got all my other support, you know, like laundry, showers, you know, I set the whole thing up myself. And then my tank commander comes down there and, you know, and I'm not going to make a guy get up and go eat breakfast if he didn't want to.
Right.
And so anyway, every morning we had the truck to this mess place to eat. So in the morning, the platoon sergeant would get up and say, okay, everybody wants to go eat breakfast. You know, get up, let's go. And so anyway, everyone who wanted to eat would get up and go, you know, get on the truck and go eat breakfast. Well, these two guys had driven down a couple of dump trucks the night before, and I guess they didn't get the word. And so the battalion commander shows up, and he says, well, did you get to eat breakfast?
No.
You know, these guys were like complaining they didn't get to eat breakfast. And so anyway, he starts, I'm out of my Jeep and I come in and the Jeep parks and it's got a whip antenna.
Okay.
And it's like secured on the front with a clip.
Okay.
So it doesn't, you know,
yeah.
going around up in the air while you're going.
Yeah.
And just as I parked, the damn clip came off and that antenna just shot up like that. And of course he didn't see that. And he was mad at me because those guys didn't eat breakfast and my antenna was up. And he came over there and he was just like, just a little short guy. I swear he wasn't 5'3", 5'4".
Right.
Little short guy. And he had a temper. And he was just yelling at me and screaming at me. And he got up on top of my Jeep and grabbed that antenna and put it down. And I was just like, you know, you guys sent me down here with nothing.
Yeah.
And all that happened was these two idiots didn't get on the truck to go eat breakfast, and my whip antenna came up, and you're chewing me out, you know, and not giving me any credit for anything.
Yeah.
You know? And things like that would, you know, kind of get you.
Right. I see what you mean. All right. One last question here before we kind of wrap things up. What words of wisdom would you like future generations to know? Is there anything you want to pass along or tell them about military service or things you've learned? Or
I would say I think everybody should serve. Mm-hmm. But I know you can't because the Army's not big enough. But like this past year, the Army, because of President Trump, they expanded the military budget and they've expanded the number of people enlistments. And for the first time, I know the economy's good. So a lot of times when the economy is doing really good, you know, there's not very many people are wanting to get into the service
mm-hmm.
because they want to go, you know, the other route. And they missed their goal by like 76,000. And that's quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I would say, I think everybody needs to serve. If you got the chance to serve, you should serve. And I would say you'll never regret it. Never regret serving.
Okay.
And
sounds good. Yeah. Thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to share? Any more experiences? Anything you want to? Or do you feel like you're
going to? I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
I can't really think of anything.
No, that's fine, yeah.
Had a funny story one time happened.
Go for it, yeah, absolutely.
I was an advisor. When I was an advisor to the National Guard, all the, you know, National Guard and Reserve units, you know, they did their ATs, or mm-hmm. summer camps, two weeks out of the year.
Right.
I got sent down to, where was that? Down in Virginia, as a big training area where the National Guard goes, Fort AP Hill. And I went down there, and I was doing this, I think they were from, like, Georgia or something, real southern drawl.
Okay.
Real southern accent. And so one of my things I was supposed to do is at night I had to evaluate them. That's what I was there for.
Okay.
And they were an engineer unit. So I'd go out at night and I'd walk around their perimeter to see if they had guards up and stuff like that. Well, one night it was really, really dark and I stumbled in and all of a sudden this M60 machine gun just opened up. I mean, Even blanks are loud as
yeah,
hell.
Yeah.
I mean, it just blow your ears out. And I'm going, you know, I said, what? You know, stop, cease fire. And I walk up to the guy and he says, aren't you supposed to do the challenge and password? And challenge and password, okay, when someone comes up, you say, you know, halt.
Right.
And then that tells you to halt. It's supposed to say, you know, the challenge, but like the challenge and password is red oak.
Right.
So the guy that challenges you is supposed to say red, and you're supposed to respond oak.
Right.
So you don't get shot.
Exactly.
So they know you're friendly. And he just opened up and just blew me away. And I walked in there and I says, and then all of a sudden his NCO showed up at the pit wanting to know what the hell was going on, you know, his gun emplacement. And so I'm sitting there trying to, you know, talk to him, you know. And I says, well, don't you know what the challenge and password is? And I walked him through that. And he said something like, you know, I can't, so what did he say? God, I forgot what I was going to say. something about he couldn't, damn it. Oh, I said, and I walked him through that. Okay, that's what I did. I walked him through it, challenging password. This is how you're supposed to do it. Let's try it again.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to go back out there, and then you're going to challenge me, and then I'm going to give the response, right?
Yeah,
just
right.
to make sure he knows how to do it. This guy, he's like, he'd been in the damn National Guard for years, you know. He knew all this crap. He was just screwing with it. And he says, well, I can't, sir. I said, why not? You know, I was like mad.
Yeah.
Why not? Because I ran out of ammunition. So I was just like, I just died. I just rolled over laughing. His NCO was just like shocked when the guy says, I can't, sir. Yeah. Why not? Because I ran out of ammunition. And he was just looking at me like how he was going to respond. And I just rolled over laughing. That was like one of the funniest things that ever happened to me.
That's great.
Well, yeah, that's about it.
Well, thank you very much, Travis. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming in
and
talking with me. Have a good rest of your day.